Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. Before we kick off the show, I suppose it is worth looking at what we have been covering on the show for the longest time. And that's some weird laws. I thought we would give you one or two to say goodbye. We did say we were going to come to the end of this series, and we have been running through quite a bit of them throughout the year on the show. And I did say that we're going to be trying something else. But for now, I suppose it's important to note that if you find yourself in the state of Alabama, you are not allowed to be setting off or celebrating with confetti. They have something against confetti, and confetti alongside things referred to as stink bombs, which are offensive smelling or potentially injurious substances, could earn you a year in jail or up to $6,000 as a fine. You're tuned into the SFM Market Update with Money Web. On the show today, we're going to be taking a look at Optasia's listing, rather. They listed on the JSE officially today. We're going to speak to the CEO. We spoke to the CEO towards the end of October around the plans to list and what was happening there. The IPO went live officially today, making it the largest IPO on the African continent. We're going to take a look at that and see what it means for the JSE, what it means for Optasia, and what it means for investors. We also have a conversation with the team at Tax Consulting SA, taking a look at the foreign pension exemption that was set to be removed by National Treasury. It seems there's been a U-turn in that conversation. We're going to see what those latest developments are following the Standing Committee of Finances meeting today. Then we have a conversation with the Chief Commissioner at the International Trade and Administration Commission, ITAC, taking a look at the scrap metal discount and what has been gazetted around that and what that means for scrap metal traders. Then we're going to wrap up the show with a property conversation. We're going to be taking a look at protecting yourself as a home buyer in a transaction against cyber attacks.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Of course, it wouldn't be much of a market update if we didn't get a sense of what's been happening in the markets throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Head of Research at FNB Wealth and Investments, Chantal Marks, to take a look at market movements and see what we make of them. Chantal, lovely to have you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. What happened today? It's a sea of red. I can't find a single equity market in the green. And South African markets, I know we'll get into around the resources correlation and what's been happening there. But globally, it just doesn't look like it was a good day.
No, absolutely not. I mean, if you just look at a stock like Palantir, which has kind of rallied 150-odd% so far this year, a lot of enthusiasm around AI, reporting excellent, excellent results last night, down 7.5% today. And I think that that kind of gives me an idea of the broader thematic here. Investors are getting really worried about valuations. And from what I understand, there were some comments made by several big bank CEOs saying that they think a correction might be on the cards for the S&P 500. And that really has resulted in a broader kind of risk-off sentiment dominating financial markets today. And certainly it has spilled over to the JSE. It's spilled over to metal prices and by extension miners. But surprisingly, gold really not a beneficiary of this fear. And I think that has to do with a stronger US dollar.
The US dollar is seemingly fighting back. And if I look at some of the data that you alluded to around what's happening with US companies and how they've been treated, I'm looking at something around I think it's the US population as well. It seems as though the majority of the US population live in a state of recession at the moment. This is at least according to the global markets data that has been put out recently by the Federal Reserve as part of their research. This is a worrying turn because this is typically what we see around times of a recession. We saw it in the pandemic and we saw it in the 2008 financial crisis. It looks as though it's very much the same. Is this an indication of the fact that perhaps the US consumer isn't doing as well as the US might have thought they would be?
Yeah, it does seem as if the US the US economy is being held up by rich people and AI vibes at this point in time, because there really is a massive disparity in terms of the health of the lower and middle income consumer and the high income consumer. And of course, all the data that we're getting is super aggregated, and that means that you can't really get into the nitty-gritty. But if you just read the headlines around this government shutdown and what failure to reach an agreement on medical care and food stamps, for example, can mean for a very large chunk of the US population, it really puts into focus the inequalities in that economy. And yeah, I mean, it is certainly very, very concerning because, yeah, you can kind of push through this for a while, but eventually you start getting serious societal problems as well. And the recession-like conditions in among lower and middle income consumers can very easily spill into the broader financial system. So definitely something that we're keeping an eye on. And I think that it is another thing that markets are waking up to at the moment.
Chantal, speaking of the broader financial system, yes, the Nasdaq was down today, but Asian markets didn't fare better, and they would have been trading before a lot of the US-related news would have come out. European markets didn't fare better either. The DAX in Germany down, the CAC 40 in France down as well. The Rand is even weaker. The Rand we'll get to in a moment because I suspect it's what you mentioned around the US dollar strength. But what's happening from an international markets perspective? Are markets just spooked with some of these developments? Are markets just taking a bit of a breather?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think if you look at where kind of the trigger point was, it was actually post-market in the US where Palantir, for example, released results, and there were several other results releases as well. And that kind of spilled into the Asian trading session and then spilled into the European trading session as well. I think that there are also broader concerns in some of these Asian economies. Valuations in AI-related stocks have run away in other jurisdictions as well. We had a warning, for example, this morning on SK Hynix, which is a semiconductor company in South Korea, where the South Korean regulator actually issued a trading warning because the share price was up by so much in a very short period of time. So these moves are starting to spook market participants globally. It's not only a US story. And then, of course, you also have growth concerns globally. You have political uncertainty. You've got monetary policy uncertainty. And I think when something like a trigger point like the Palantir results and the sudden sell-off after market on really, really strong results can have a spillover impact, especially when things are so fragile.
So, Chantal, are you telling us to stay away from the markets at the moment, or are you saying that there are some areas that do still offer value? I mean, the AI story has definitely run hot, at least for the last 5 years. I mean, really, I think about it, it goes as far back as the pandemic, and at some point a cool down would be necessary. Are we saying that this is kind of the tipping point for markets in general, or is it too soon to tell?
I think it's too soon to tell. I think one of the strategies that you may want to follow is to keep some powder dry. Maybe take some profits on positions that have done very well for you and wait for a correction in order to gain exposure to perhaps some companies you missed the initial rally on, or specific themes that you are underinvested in. And then I also think that there is major value in some of the large cap kind of consumer discretionary stocks globally that aren't really the flavor of the week at, or let's say the flavor of the last 2 years. And then I also think that in the South African context, things are really seemingly going a little bit better domestically, but it really isn't displayed in the valuations, particularly in the South African retailers and the broader industrial space. So I think that there's opportunity there, but you need to kind of ride through these waves of volatility. It's not going to be an overnight story, but certainly buying some of these stocks at much lower PEs than what we're used to is probably a good strategy right now.
Chantal, outlook going into 2026. I know it's still very, very far away at this point in time. We still have the Santa rally to get through. You and I love talking about that. But does this start to shape what happens next year. I know some portfolio managers use this last quarter of the year to perhaps look at how do we now tackle the new year, understanding that, of course, a lot of it is dependent on data that comes out of places like the US Fed and the South African Reserve Bank in local cases. But does this start to influence the fact that the optimism that might have been set out for 2026 might start to look a bit different now?
Yeah, I think that the valuation story is going to remain front and center, because I don't think we're necessarily going to get a calming down of the things that are making investors and markets generally quite skittish going into next year. So I think there's going to be a lot of thought that goes into what US valuations look like currently, specifically in the AI space. Do we want to kind of pivot a little bit? I think a lot of investors will think about that. We'll look at the South African story. Where do we see additional value going in 2026? How do we think economic growth is going to fare in 2026? We know it was a disappointment specifically this year. I think then you also have to look at your outlook for commodity prices, because we've seen over the last week or so the massive impact that commodity pricing, specifically gold and PGMs, can have on the JSE. I mean, there's a spillover effect from weaker resources into somewhat generally negative sentiment around South Africa and the South African market. So we'll have to consider those things. There's obviously still a lot of news flow over the next two months that's due. Hopefully at some point we can get some data giving us a better idea of what's happening in the US economy. We also have a lot of factors that can still sway local bond valuations. For example, we've got a medium-term budget policy statement to get through. We've got some decisions from the credit ratings agencies to get through. And I think all of that will be important in order to shape a cohesive idea of what could possibly happen in 2026.
Well, you brought it up, Chantal. What are your expectations for MTBPS next week? I know you and I might not get to chat on air about it, but I will certainly have a conversation around it. But what are your thoughts around what could be coming out of next week's midterm statement, and potentially what would you like to see come out of that? We know sometimes it can be a bit of a quieter event from National Treasury, yeah, but it still is important.
Yes. So, I mean, the MTBPS is basically just going to tell us how government's finances are faring. I think from the high frequency data, we can assume that it's going slightly better than what they thought it was going relative to what they thought in February, March, May, whichever budget iteration you want to look at. So I think that it's faring slightly better, and then they'll give us clues in terms of potential policy direction. So what we would not want to hear as consumers is the potential for tax increases. What we would want to hear is potential taxation relief if collections are running ahead of expectations. And then I am hoping for some clues in terms of National Treasury's thinking around the 3% inflation target. When are they going to kind of give it the rubber stamp? I know in principle, it seems as if they're on board, but I think that it could be really meaningful if that alignment takes place and we can get an idea of where they are in that process.
Chantal, let's wrap up with what that alignment will do for the rand. 17.47 at the moment, 48-ish on against the US dollar. We've come from levels of 17.05 just a couple of days ago. We haven't been able to actually breach 17 rand really and sustainably stay at that level. Do we see this as potentially a catalyst to finally get over that line? Is that enough, if anything, to finally push us below 17 rand if we start to see things like the alignment and start to see kind of factors in favor of the rand coming together?
Yeah, so I think it will certainly help. But the broader issue facing the rand over the last week or so are the exact things that are having an impact on the gold mining shares and the PGM shares and JSE generally. if commodity prices are coming under pressure, that is not good for our terms of trade, and by extension, that's not good for the rand. And if the US dollar is strengthening, that's not good for the rand either. So I think if you're going to see a continuation of the kind of broader strengthening trend that we've seen since the middle of this year, you will need dollar weakness and you will need strong commodity pricing. But it certainly will help if we get positive policy signals from National Treasury as well.
We can only hope to get good news out of National Treasury to improve the rand's movements. It is holding its ground, but it seems as though markets have got a lot to weigh up, and whether or not these factors remain positive, only time will tell. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thank you, as always, to Chantal Marks, Head of Research at FNB Wealth and Investments, for joining us to take a look at markets.
Imagine if you could save time like you save money. A second here, a minute there. Type a little faster. Walk a little faster. Or you could stop scrolling on the internet. Just think of all the hours you'll save. Now what if you could take all that time and invest it? Watch it grow. Until eventually, one day, you'd have so much time that you wouldn't know what to do with it all. But unfortunately, time doesn't work like that. It can't be stored or banked. And unlike money, you can't make it back. That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do whatever you want to do, even if it is scrolling on the internet. Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
In a year where history has been made on the local bourse, it is interesting that we look back on the final month of the year as we start the final month with even more history. Today, the largest IPO in African history made its debut on the JSE, and that is, of course, Optasia. We caught up with the Optasia CEO a couple of weeks ago ahead of today in anticipation of what would happen today. And we're going to speak to Salvador Anglada once again now to get a sense of how today went. Salvador, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Certainly a historic moment for Optasia, but also for Optasia to be able to make history on the African continent. How was the first day of trade?
Well, hello, everybody. Very happy, of course, as you said, the largest IPO in Africa and the largest also fintech IPO in EMEA, in Europe, Middle East and Africa. It was a good day for us. We just finalized the day in positive while the index were negative all across the day. So very happy for the reception of the IPO in the market.
Now, Salvador, the share sale price clocking above 19 Rand a piece on around 1.2 billion odd shares in issue puts the market valuation of the company just north of 23 billion Rand, or around $1.5 billion, just shy of that. That's not a small business, especially to start off with, and what you're coming into the market at.
Well, it's not, but I think it's reflecting also the potential of the business itself, all what we have done, but also what it's expecting for us to do. As you know, we are already operating in 38 countries. We have more than 120 million active customers every month, and the opportunity is there. We have still more than 1.7 billion in the world that are, we call it unbanked, people they don't have access to financial services, and this is what we're doing. We are allowing them to get that, not only in Africa, but also in other continents. We're looking also at Southeast Asia as a potential next destination for us to continue growing at the same time that we grow, of course, in Africa.
Salvador, let's look at that in a bit more detail. Let's look at the strategy now. I mean, the IPO is behind you. It is a tense time for any business when listing. There's a lot that goes into that. But now the management team gets to squarely focus on the expansionary plans. And you mentioned, of course, Southeast Asia. I know Latin America is also on your radar in terms of what it is you're looking at. How are you now going to be approaching the market, understanding that you might very well have quite an edge in emerging markets?
Well, I think the same way that we are approaching today. I think we have a big opportunity in Africa. Still, there are a lot of countries that we have not presence. jets in East Africa, but also in North Africa. And this is what we're doing. We have a good pipeline of opportunities, continue expanding our business, and also new products that we will launch into the market. So it's not only just to look at Asia, Southeast Asia, as you said, and potentially Latin America, but I mean the opportunity is still huge and big in Asia. As I said, I mean the number of people that they have not have access to banks and financial. What does is precisely to provide this opportunity to these people, not to get opportunity to get loans and to use that for the daily life, or also in the case of small and medium businesses to be able to use it for managing and financing their working capital in order to grow. So the opportunity is there, it's clear, and we're going to continue executing in that front.
Salvador, can we take a look at your operations? I mean, in the fintech space, there's a lot of smaller fintech companies that are offering very similar products, definitely potentially not even at the same scale as what Optasia would then bring to market. Does that then, from your perspective as a business, look, or when you look at those businesses, do you see them as potential acquisition opportunities, or is it a situation where you know your tech, you've been developing your tech since the business has been around since 2012? I mean, this is not a new business by any stretch of the imagination. And is it potentially an opportunity for you to say, hey, in some cases, we could leverage our tech into other businesses through partnerships, and perhaps that'll be beneficial to everyone?
It is. I think we are, I mean, one way we continue executing, as you said, we trust on our platform, we trust on our the AI power, or the power of AI to run our algorithms and to manage the data, to provide credit and to create credit scoring for people. But on the other side, we are a company that we are all the time looking for partnerships, as you said. I mean, we are a B2B2C model. And yes, I mean, the alternative to partner with others, or the alternative even to do small acquisitions that allow us to accelerate, is in the agenda, and it could happen. And we will see that depending on the potential and the quality of these companies. We will see that in the coming months.
Salvador, before I let you go, I want to get a sense of your thoughts around just the participation from a shareholder perspective. I mean, one of the leading banks in South Africa, in the form of First Rand, took up a 20% stake in Optasia from the listing. That, in and of itself, is a statement to the market of confidence in the service and the product. And Optasia, as a fintech business, operates much like any other fintech business in the world. How important is it to be able to go out into the market on your first day and be able to, one, show the valuations that we've been seeing, and two, show that the strength of the investors that are backing the business are really confident that you'll succeed?
Well, I hope so. You're totally right. I mean, bank like First Rand just giving us the confidence, the support, believing in what we're doing, our technology, our platform, and the way that we are providing credit scoring with alternative data is like alternative credit bureau. It's a big vote of confidence, I have to say that, and it definitely has helped. I mean, the whole IPO at the end of the day, which is the IPO was several times oversubscribed. The quality of the investors and the book was quite high, and also it allowed us to go to the top of the range, 19 run, as you just mentioned. So, well, I think it's one step more, but yeah, we are absolutely happy with this support, and I hope that it will help. I mean, the evolution of the share and the price in the coming weeks and the coming months, depending, of course, on the way that we're delivering our results and how we are executing on our prospect.
Well, it certainly was a star-studded affair in terms of the support from the investment community. I mean, the likes of 27Four Investment Managers, the likes of Standard Bank that were involved in the IPO, the likes of Investec being involved there, a clear sign from the financial services sector of South Africa that this listing would be successful and would succeed. Salvador, we wish you and your team all of the very best going into the year, going into your official position as a listed entity. We look forward to catching up as your story continues to unfold. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Chief Executive Officer at Optasia, Salvador Anglada, joining me today to reflect on their first trading day.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
In a world where a lot can change in 6 years, you can rest assured that Hino's 6-year drivetrain warranty won't. All Hino trucks now come standard with a 6-year drivetrain warranty, protecting your investment all the way from pistons to gears. Built to keep your business moving, supporting uptime, growth, and daily operations. Because although a lot can change in 6 years, our warranty promise won't. Terms and conditions apply. Hino all the way.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So back in August of 2025, earlier this year, there was a proposal by National Treasury as part of the Tax Laws Amendment Bill to make some adjustments to the Income Tax Act of 1962. There's a specific section in there. We won't bog you down with the details. The long and short of it is that there was going to be a removal of a tax exemption that was placed on foreign pensions. This has been reversed by Treasury as of today, and we're going to take a look at this and see what implications this would now have. I'm joined on the line by the team lead for cross-border taxation at Tax Consulting South Africa, Jean-Paul Frazier, to take a look at and see what we make of it. Jean-Paul, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with an understanding of the implications of this particular exemption and why Treasury sought to remove it.
So I think a very good starting point. Needless to say, a starting point in that regard is that this was never meant to be a long-standing or permanent provision. However, it has been in effect for 25 years now. So based on that, an alternative law is to bring certainty. So this exemption relates to pension funds that have been invested in offshore. They relate primarily to those South Africans who seek brighter futures, let's say in the Middle East, America, UK, to earn a bit of income for their retirement and their families back in South Africa in return. It also affects those foreign nationals who look to retire into South Africa just because of its natural beauty, whatever the case may be. Needless to say, those individuals who are either coming back or relocating to South Africa bring with them large amounts of investment and capital based on their foreign pensions. So it generally applied to those categories of people. And in that regard, is obviously where that exemption then gets removed, is a big deterrent for those individuals to actually or incentivize coming back to South Africa or relocating to South Africa. So if the words to simplify it is it went from a 0% tax to all of a sudden being a full tax on their foreign pension, which obviously has been planned for, let's say, 20 years, you know.
Now, Jean-Paul, today there was a meeting with the Standing Committee of Finance to discuss this amongst other issues. Can you tell us the conclusion of that meeting and what the current or what the new position is on this particular section?
Yeah, perfect. I think what I must commend the process on itself is that they did, or Parliament, National Treasury and SARS did hear out stakeholders and did take comments and submissions into consideration. And where it was proposed to completely remove this exemption and tax foreign pensions, the outcome of today was that the proposed amendment removing this exemption has been withdrawn. So they refer to it as partially accepted in terms of us submitting that it should not be implemented. So they've gone back to the drawing board essentially to see how they can go about doing this in a manner that it wouldn't have such negative consequences that it would have had at this stage.
So, Jean-Paul, to be clear, we are not completely out of the woods. There is always a possibility that this particular exemption could be looked at again in future and Treasury could take a different decision. But for now, there is a bit of reprieve for those that have the foreign pensions.
Spot on, correct. And I think a highly needed reprieve considering that it would have taken effect from 1 March next year already. So very short notice if it did get implemented.
Jean-Paul, I want to take a look at the double tax implications for South Africans in particular that might have offshore exposure and that might have offshore transactions that also coincide with their local transactions or their local investments. Can we perhaps take a look at that in the context of, one, the pension and the retirement planning, but also just where this kind of decision by National Treasury leaves them and leaves SARS if they're looking at the future of these sort of relationships?
I think a great question. And firstly, I must say that the sole purpose or the main purpose behind this amendment was to eliminate what's called double non-taxation. So individuals who have pensions or coming from the UK, for example, that double tax agreement between the UK and South Africa provided that you are taxed where you are a tax resident, for example. So where you come to South Africa and you have a UK pension, or you've worked in the UK and you come to South Africa and have a UK pension, you would then be taxed in South Africa under that double tax treaty. Our local South African tax law, however, exempts foreign pensions. So in other words, there would be no tax payable anywhere. This is a minority of double tax agreements. So it's not all of them, but generally you would find that you would be either taxable in one state under a double tax agreement, or if I could say in terms of this scenario, non-taxable anywhere. So it's always important to remember, firstly, that not all countries have double tax agreements with South Africa. So your starting point is, firstly, currently there's an exemption in South Africa. Secondly, is if that is not applicable anymore, let's say the amendment was passed, or even currently, if it doesn't classify as a pension and it's other types of investments, you would need to look at whether your country has a double tax agreement and what that provision says. And bearing in mind that not all double tax agreements are the same. So,
John Paul, speaking of other types of products, you alluded to this now, and I want to get an understanding of whether or not the provision that we currently have in our legislation applies to other products like annuities and lump sums for South African tax residents if they hold these sorts of products offshore.
It definitely does, but also important to remember in terms of the referred to it as Regulation 28, where you retirement and pension and those types of annuities are taxed very different. So you need to make sure that where you are investing in certain offshore products, that it is classified as a retirement or pension benefit. There are instances where some of these products are promoted as such, but actually there's a binding ruling with SARS is still valid. If I'm correct, binding ruling 80 refers to these types of products, and they are not generally classified as retirement or pension benefits. So it wouldn't fall under that exemption. So just there are some scenarios where clients actually have brought this up, and the unfortunate reality is that it's not protected under that exemption because it's not classified as a lump sum from a retirement or an annuity or a pension, for example.
And this is why it's very important to have conversations with your tax consultants, tax practitioners, and financial advisors, because this show does not provide you with financial advice. John Paul and his team might be able to, but you'd have to contact them directly. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thank you so much to John Paul Frazier of Tax Consulting South Africa for joining us to take a look at the reprieve provided for foreign pensions in South Africa at the moment.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Almost 5 years ago, the pandemic crippled the global travel sector, and many thought we would never travel again. But as the holiday season approaches, millions of travelers are packing their bags and contributing to the sector's ongoing recovery. Tune into the SAFM Market Update tomorrow evening at 6:45 as Allan Gray Portfolio Manager Talia Patosis joins the show to explore some of the compelling opportunities in global travel for long-term investors. Brought to you by Allan Gray. More than 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
To wrap up the month of October, the International Trade and Administration Commission gazetted the amended export control guidelines for the exportation of ferrous and non-ferrous waste and scrap. We're going to unpack this with the Chief Commissioner at ITAC. Of course, we're going to try and get a better sense of what that means in simple English. I'm joined on the line by the Chief Commissioner, Ayabonga Tawe, to take a look at the latest gazette and what it means for the scrap metal space. Commissioner, always lovely having you on the show. Thank you so much for taking the time. Let's start with a bit of context around what happened that led to the guidelines being reviewed and subsequently how we got to this point.
Thank you very much, Jimmy, as always, for the opportunity to speak to you and to your listeners. And thank you so much for giving us the chance to come and talk to our people about some of the changes that we've had here at the Commission. Well, Jimmy, I think maybe some context would be helpful. Many members of the public would be aware that since 2013, over the last 12 years or so, the export of ferrous and non-ferrous scrap wastes and other materials of a metal sort have been subject to export control, which means prior to their export, one would be obliged to go and get a permit, which would then authorize that party to export the said materials. And these would be exported to mills across the world who would use the scrap as input material. And certainly from 2013, there would have been in policy terms an obligation on some of these exporters to first offer this scrap at a discount to the prevailing world market price to domestic fabricators of scrap. So these would be people in South Africa who make all manner of steel, copper, aluminium, embedded type products where scrap is input material. And so what has happened in this instance is on the back of us administering this for over a decade, in the course of doing so, we would have encountered all manner of problems and challenges and even, I guess, opportunities to recalibrate and to reassess some of the assumptions that have informed how it is that we administer this. So this is really a review on a few fronts that is informed by the obligation we have to periodically review the price preference point system. But also, I think many of your listeners would be aware that we had published on the 8th of May this year a directive we had received from the Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition to consider one element as well of the guidelines, which relates to this discount to the world market price or the prevailing world market price of scrap. And in this instance, we've done so. And so happy really to discuss tonight some of the key areas where we've made amendments to that export control framework for the benefit of some of your listeners.
Commissioner, let's get into that. Let's get into the changes specifically that have been made. And then after the changes, we could potentially get into the impact that might have on local providers as well as what goes out into the export market. Let's start with the changes.
Sure. Well, three areas, Jimmy. And I've indicated we've been doing this since about 2013. And the discount is one area that has changed. The discount initially began at around 20% in 2013. It was amended in 2015. To 30% because the burden of the logistics and transportation costs at that point rested on the buyers. And so in a sense, a 20% discount, if you add onto that the cost of dispatching some of the scrap, effectively eroded the depth of that discount. And so the policymakers then and my predecessor would have been part of a process to amend that in January 2015. Subsequent to that, in 2021, there was an amendment that then shifted the locus of the transport cost away from the buyer to the seller of the scrap. And that happened in 2021. And I think arising from that and also our own reading of the demand conditions in the global market for scrap, we've subsequently taken a decision here to amend it from 30% to 25%. We've also, second to that, moved to shift all of these transactions that unfold under the PPS away from cash transactions. It is our considered view that all of those transactions should be happening electronically and on the national payment system. And I think you'd be aware as to why we would do that in the context, of course, of all the discussions we're having, whether those are around the FATF and the grey list, which we've just come out of. But also in 2022, during the ban we had, there was a move to also indicate that at some point the sector would be expected to make all of its transactions on electronic platforms, and that's still something that is being worked towards. So that's the first change, that the discount is moving from 30% to 25%. The second one is that we're shifting all the transactions away from cash towards transactions that can be done on the national payment system. The third change is an institutional change, Jimmy. We're introducing a technical working group. And in the Gazette we issued on Friday, one would have seen the terms of reference for this technical working group, which would be appointed by the Chief Commissioner in line with Section 23 of the International Trade Administration Act. And this would be composed of members of the Commission, representatives of the Receiver of Revenue, SARS, and also industry actors and players across different segments of the buyer and even scrap merchant community. such that we're able at least to have the wealth of knowledge of some of these industry actors as we make sense of global conditions. And you would know, I mean, some of these conditions are shifting rapidly. Take a look, for instance, at some of the outlook we're hearing from the mines about copper production, increasing use of copper in wind turbines, electric vehicles, data centers, and so on. And, of course, the surge we've seen in the price of copper clearing the $11,000 per ton mark, all of which is indicating that there will probably be increasing reliance on scraps, waste, and other secondary material or recycled material for copper as some of the mines battle to kind of pump out a lot more of the stuff, which, of course, will bring into sharp focus the PPS and, of course, its regulation of the export of copper and many of the other secondary and tertiary challenges associated with that. So we think we would benefit in line with the export control regulations with having a technical working group from which we can then be able to draw insight, engage, and also be able to kind of manage some of the complications associated with administering a program of this kind. So those are the three changes, Jimmy. Really, on the discount, the cash payment challenge, and then, of course, the institutional shift towards a TWG.
Nobody said modernizing systems was going to be an easy task, but the team at ITAC continues to do that. Commissioner, I want to take a look at what this potentially means for local operators, international operators, especially in the context of conversations you and I have previously had around striking that balance between protecting the market, but with also not endangering and restricting trade.
Well, indeed. I mean, I think we certainly, I've always said to you, Jimmy, that we're not interested in autarky here. We're not interested in kind of a blanket ban at this stage on the export of ferrous or non-ferrous scrap. Not at all. But we are reading some of the signals globally. One of those signals, for instance, was the budget speech of the Indian finance minister, Nirmala Sitharaman, earlier on this year, where they indicated the Calcutta government that they would be reducing the prohibitions on the importation of scrap into their country. That make it easier for many merchants to import scrap because they need more scrap than they are able to generate as a country. Similarly, we've also heard from the Eurozone increasing restrictions on the exportation of scrap, and there's a big lobby there to ban the export of scrap. And so everybody, as the steel and other forms of downstream fabrication are trying to green their operations, scrap becomes a critical and a strategic material. And so in our sense, really this move is to recalibrate things. There were certain assumptions that were made in 2015. Those assumptions, as I've indicated, no longer hold. It's to recalibrate that while still retaining the disincentive, even when price conditions are favorable in the global market, for there to be this kind of wanton export of scrap. We do want people, yes, there are many people who have business models that are in exporting scrap, but the principle is that that scrap ought to be made available to the domestic fabricators, especially if you take, for instance, stainless steel. We have a firm in South Africa that fabricates stainless steel. The nature and the quality of scrap they require is often heavy sections coming through from the rail operator, automotive grades of scrap, all of the same scrap you would imagine that many fabricators in places like Turkey and India as the main importers are looking for the same scrap. And so in a sense, the policy signal is on two fronts. One, that we've kind of read the mood, reading the sense of what the data is telling us and moved in this direction, but also reinforcing right up until the PPS, of course, which is intended to end around 31 July 2027. We don't know if it will be extended, and I think the minister will probably give guidance on that. But it's really to say that as a country, we continue to deem scrap as a strategic material, crucial to also the greening of our own steel sector. But really, this is to just recalibrate the calculus of where the discount would rest, and of course, in relation to where the logistics costs in line with the regulations currently rest.
I suppose, Commissioner, it's always nice that this recalibration also lines up ever so conveniently with our conversation around beneficiation, a conversation you and I have had quite at length, to say that there is opportunity for beneficiation and these sorts of strategic changes continue to open that up.
Well, indeed. I mean, you would know, Jimmy, that we, following a decision by Cabinet in June to place chrome under export control, have alongside the department published the Gazette soliciting comment, and I know the comments for that closed on Friday. And that's if you take the stainless steel value chain, where chrome and ferrochrome is a critical input alongside scrap in the fabrication of stainless steel, is very much a beneficiation play. And I think we do need to ensure that all of these instruments operate in concert. You know, it's like an orchestra. You do need all of the different instruments to come together in synchronous fashion to make for a very nice symphony. It's not always going to be easy. We're not always going to get it right, nor will it always be a costless exercise for all. But really, I think our task is to make sure that these decisions are made on the balance of evidence in line with our policy framework as we understand it, and always give an opportunity, as we did in September 2024 and in May. It took us 13 months to make this decision, arising primarily from the obligation for us to consult. And I think we've tried to do that in this instance. But we also recognize that as these guidelines came into effect on Friday, on the 31st of October, that it's a moving picture. And we really welcome the institutional change now that will allow us to have this dialogue as the administrators of the PPS with the industry in the form of the technical working group. Because I think that's also an important part of democratic policymaking. And we look forward in the coming weeks to send some letters to the industry bodies to say, send us your representatives to form part of the technical working group. And maybe at some point we'll come back and tell you how that's working.
And we will hold you to that, Commissioner. We will wait on that. For those that are wanting to contribute towards that technical working group, you have a 2-week window of submission to submit your recommendations and your thoughts around these developments. For now, we're going to have to leave this conversation on that note. Thank you ever so much to the Chief Commissioner of the International Trade and Administration Commission, Chief Commissioner Ayabonga Tlawe, for taking us through some of the amended export control guidelines and what this means for the scrap metals sector.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It is Property Tuesday, and we are taking a look at protecting property transactions this week with the growing rate and the growing threat of cyber criminals and cyber attacks. When you do property transactions, especially transactions of a large size, the last thing you want is to be the victim of a cybercrime. I'm joined on the line by the head of Buyers Trust, Jackie Smith, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Jackie, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. I imagine with the property transactions that take place in any market, not just in South Africa, there are threats to transactions. There are threats towards the deals going ahead. But in 2025, I suppose cyber threats are even bigger at this point.
Hi, Jimmy. Yes, absolutely correct. If you had a look at Interpol's recent stats that they've published, it showed that South Africa now ranks as the second most targeted country in Africa for cybercrime, and this is behind Egypt. So 100% we've seen a significant increase in cyber threat and cyber fraud, and specifically around the property industry. The reason for this being that obviously it is an industry where there's a high value exchange happening, and that is what cyber criminals are interested in.
Jackie, how do these threats manifest themselves? Because I think about a property transaction and I'm dealing with an estate agent. I'm also then dealing with attorneys. Yes, there are a couple of people in the process, but how do these threats start to pop up, and how can property buyers potentially identify them?
That's a great question. So if you look at what was published by Uber Home Loans recently in the Uberometer, it showed that there was an average property price increase, right, of 3.9% year on year. So the average purchase price is now sitting on about 1.7 million. So what's happening is that that is an indication that the activity in the market has increased. So there's more attorneys, there's more real estate agents, and absolutely wonderful for the market that you've seen the activity increase. But what has happened in that process is that you've got the cyber criminals being more alert for keywords here. They are looking out for the sale of a property, a deposit, the transfer of money. And that is what has highlighted some concerns for us in the industry. Because of the renewed activity, we've seen an alarming amount of attacks specifically around email correspondence. And it's created this opportunity for them to attack attorneys and real estate agents who maybe don't have the necessary protection for their systems that can combat these cyber criminals.
So initially, I would have thought they would be targeting the buyers, but it seems they could also be impersonating legitimate players in the space like the real estate agents. So then how do we protect ourselves if that is the case, Jackie? Because that sounds like a serious problem if we're not able to discern whether or not this is a legitimate communication or not.
So they are definitely attacking firms. Without a doubt, we've seen this in the industry, but they are targeting home buyers too, Jimmy, because, you know, with COVID, we've become so complacent in terms of how we communicate. We easily just press reply on an email from a sender. We don't necessarily check the email address to see whether, you know, is it jimmy@xproperties.co.za@gmail.com. Not that there's anything wrong with Gmail accounts, but ordinarily we've just become so complacent to press reply. So what we tell buyers is that before you do anything, you always have to make sure that you verify the payment details independently. So always verify your payment details independently. Don't just react to an urgent email. Make sure that the email correspondence agrees with the property address, that you're dealing with the legitimate people. And also use secure devices and networks. Don't sit in the cafe or at the airport and then decide to make a huge transfer into someone's account that you haven't verified. And like I said earlier, you've got to check the authenticity of the email address. Make sure that you're not dealing with a Gmail account if it is a legitimate firm. And then try and use businesses that has been verified or that are authorized dealers to be, for you to deal, or that can actually keep and protect you against the cybercrime.
I think one easy thing from my side, if I remember correctly, was just picking up the phone and phoning the attorneys themselves and just confirming with the attorneys if that is the case. But Jackie, I want to get your thoughts around the transfer itself. From my understanding, and I stand to be corrected here, all funds for transactions for property purchases have to go sit in an attorney's trust account. So an immediate red flag for me is if the funds don't end up in a trust account, surely that's a problem.
That is what the attorneys would say to you must be done. But as a home buyer, you have choice. Ultimately, what you need to do is to show them that you are good for the cash, right? So if you're buying a property cash or whether you're putting down a deposit, you have to prove that you have got the money to purchase that property. And that proof can come in the form of a guarantee. It doesn't necessarily mean that the money has to sit in their bank account. You can issue them with the bank guarantee, which is what companies like ours, Buyers Trust, does on your behalf. One, you can hold the money in your own name, and we will then assist you to issue a bank guarantee against that money. You cannot be forced as a home buyer to place that money with the attorney. You need to know that you have a choice and you can issue them with the bank guarantee.
See, that is very useful information. Jackie, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the online signatures. We live in a world where contracts are entered into via digital signatures on a daily basis. Is this an area of weakness where it comes to the property transactions? Is it an area that could potentially provide security for a buyer if they know more about it?
So it could be both. One, In a property transaction, normally the estate agent would be sitting with the buyer and with the seller. So you'll find that they require a wet signature, which means that you have to get it signed in person. So I would advocate, or we would advocate, that when you are buying a property, that you make sure that you rather sign it in person with the estate agent or with the attorney, and also that the seller does that. But there's going to be instances where a document might be required to be emailed to you and they require you to do a digital signature. Make sure that, again, that you are able to verify the business that has sent it to you for signature or electronic signature, and make sure that you, before you press that submit button, have checked out that the company that they have used to process the digital signature on is a legit company.
Do your homework, folks, and get the necessary verifications and comfort before you fall victim to cyber crimes, because those are definitely on the rise. I think we'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to the head of Buyers Trust, Jackie Smith, for joining us to take a look at protecting your property transaction from cyber criminals.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That's the show for today, folks. If you've missed any of the conversations, you know where you can catch up on them. It is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Hurst is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news. He'll be followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team with the latest round of sports. So from my side, good night.